Hi everyone, I'm Jill Trebilcock and welcome to We Raw Radio. Today I have my usual producer, Stephen Roberts. Thank you so much, Stephen, as usual. Do you want to say hello, Stephen?
You're welcome, Jill. Hello, everyone.
You're very kind. And we have Professor Stuart Twemlow, a psychiatrist who we've been doing a lot of interviews with lately, and we did one recently on the Columbine Massacre. And we realised that we left out a couple of things. One was video games. There's some questions I wanted to actually ask about him because they're sort of like a cult themselves.
And
also just cults and cult formation. So welcome, Professor Stuart Twemlow. Thank you for coming again.
Pleasure.
It's always a pleasure to have you. I learn so much from you, and I get so much out of doing these interviews, and you keep saying to me that it's important for me to remember that your opinion is only one opinion, and that's a good interesting opinion. Of course, it's a good opinion. But anyway, on that point, when we were talking about the Columbine massacres, I sort of looked into it when I was looking into cult formation, and I was looking at some work by a psychiatrist called Dr. Margaret Singer or some name like that. I'm not exactly sure of her name, but anyway, I was reading up all the different steps in a cult formation, but also I was reading the papers that you were saying, and anyway, somewhere along the line I've come up with this idea is that cults only form when people are dissatisfied with the society that they're in, and so they create a counterculture.
Yeah.
So this is obviously part of the situation at Columbine too, because they had the trench coat mafia,
right?
Which seemed to have all the ingredients of a cult. Well, it was a cultish sort of a thing. Did you look into the trench coat mafia at all? And did they? I do know that I heard two contradictory things about the two boys who were involved in that in the Columbine shooting, and one said they were in the trench coat mafia and the other said they weren't. And some of the videos that they filmed, they were dressed in trench coats and they had on the berets and the sort of appearance of the trench coat mafia, but whether they were actually accepted into it or not, I don't know.
Good question, Jill, because the trench coat became a symbol. I heard that the phrase trench coat mafia was coined by the jocks, the athletes who were bullying them. And wasn't a term that the preppies with whom Harrison Klebold were identified, the non-jocks, didn't choose it themselves. Whatever it is, there's a book written by Stephen King called Rage. And in it, the boy used a trench coat so he could hide a rifle and various other weapons inside the trench coat. And it became a good symbol for somebody intent on killing. You would wear this sort of big overcoat to carry around your rifles and shotguns and bombs and hand grenades and all of that. But you raise this issue of cult formation, and I wanted to just mention that in a little bit more detail, because I think a cult was formed at Columbine. And it came to me some years after writing a paper in 2008 on the Jonestown massacre. You remember, occurred, I think, in 1976 in Jonestown, Ghana, where around 900 people committed suicide one night. About 137 or so were shot, and the rest of them drank a drink like Kool-Aid. Wasn't Kool-Aid, but some sort of fizzy drink with cyanide in it. And they administered it to their children, and the adults drank it themselves. Now, this group were, of course, composed of hundreds of people, many of whom were intelligent professionals. One, I think, was even a congressional politician. There were lots of attorneys and and doctors, and they weren't all sort of hippies looking for a new life or dissatisfied people searching for some salvation by a minister. Jim Jones himself was really regarded as an altruistic figure. He held very, very close to his heart a letter from President Carter supporting his work. He was one of the very early ministers who proposed allowing or encouraging black participation in white churches in the Pentecostal religion, I think he belonged to. And Carter wrote him a letter of support for himself. He eventually had what, I mean, who knows? Nobody examined him psychiatrically, but he developed the idea that he was being looked at by the FBI and that his phones were being tapped and his people were being investigated. And frankly, with the events of the last year that we have all seen with the National Security Agency and Mr. Snowden and the extraordinary ring of people looking into our private correspondence, I have a little more sympathy for his what was called then gross paranoia.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever it was, he got sufficiently suspicious, primarily of the FBI, to form a small group and go to Ghana and set up Jonestown. And then, as it became established, there was a visit by a group of congressmen, and you know the story. They were killed trying to get away, and really his whole group became a sort of, by then, murderers, and you know they entered the news as sort of unpleasant, undesirable people. And I got a copy of a tape, audio tape, mm-hmm. of the very last sermon Reverend Jones gave to the 900 participants in Jonestown.
Mm-hmm.
That sermon was so difficult to listen to. The person that I and my colleague paid to transcribe it required a lot of extra money because she couldn't listen to it. And I put it to you, if you heard it, it's no exaggeration. It's spine chilling. The yes. guts of it, essentially, he called it the final white knight sermon, in which he was telling people that when the sermon was over, they were to go back to their tents and huts and drink the cyanide with their children. They'd had several practice drinkings without cyanide to try and make children more comfortable drinking it. And this was the final sermon. And is it a sermon of revolution and promise of glory in heaven? No. It's filled with F words. It's a sermon with lots of rough, ugly language. One or two people say, one woman in it said, why would we do this? It makes no sense. I mean, I'm going to die and my family lives in California. And
yeah.
He argues back and forth with the crowd. And she actually committed suicide.
So it went on and on.
And then the next day, he was seen alive the next morning, sitting on the stage he'd spoken from with his head on his hands, saying to himself, according to reports, mother, mother, what have I done? It was like he had a sudden realization that he had murdered 900.
Yes. Yes, I can see that.
Shot. Nobody knows who actually shot him. But he and 136 others were shot. Were ones who did not want to drink the cyanide.
Oh.
And so that became a regular thing. The media revisited it. I consulted with the last revisit. Every 10 years or so, they have a press rerun on what really happened. And then George Huff, who was a psychologist friend of mine, and I wrote this paper, which looked at that Jonestown massacre as part of what is called the Christian Identity Movement. And we could simply see it as a very extremist Christian movement, mm-hmm. that interprets the Bible literally.
Literalists. Yep.
And leads people to the thinking that there's no hope left in the world and the hope is in heaven. Mm-hmm. The quicker we get there, the better we'll be. Mm. That this planet needs to be, quote, purified.
Quote, purified, absolutely. That's
Osama bin Laden said.
Yeah, that's so
just
much.
Like Harris said, purified of fuckheads.
Yeah.
In other words, all of these things were so awful. The only way out was death. That Jonestown had a sort of a neo-socialist view of the afterlife. It wasn't well articulated, but he managed to convince all those people that life on Earth was not worth living. And we think, as a result of the interaction of people in groups, that little by little the group became convinced in a psychotic fantasy that its only salvation came from death, as we think with Columbine. That Harris particularly and Klebold in the last week before the shootings became very clear in their idea that the only solution to the planet, we're not here talking about Columbine. They had gone long beyond Columbine. The planet needed to be rid of fuckheads before it could possibly become a place that human beings would want to inhabit. And so
I heard that stuff
had nothing much to do with the school itself. The school was just a symbol to the world that all of these undesirables were living, just as Jonestown had the same. And if you listen to the tape, you would hear him say it, that there's nothing left in this world worth living in. All that you will see is death and destruction.
Mm.
And I can lead you to a better life.
Mm.
And then what we did in the paper was we defined five stages of what is called regression.
Yes, you did.
Little by little, the group colludes with the leader. The leader really is the victim of the group's wishes.
Yep.
He's not, you see, the leader's, it's like the bully. The bully is not the big, bad, nasty criminal. The bully is an agent of the system. And Jim Jones and Eric Harris are agents of the system. And little by little, the system of people around Jones made him think that, through a whole set of complicated interactions we outlined, that the world needed to be rid of everybody. Or Harris's idea was his equivalent of the same thing. Osama bin Laden was all non-Muslim, whatever religious or otherwise, because, of course, Harris and Klebold were in no way religious.
Well, apparently the murders took place on Hitler's birthday.
Yeah.
Which is very interesting. Apparently that was a deliberately chosen date, was Hitler's birthday.
Why? And as you know, as you might imagine, I've treated many children who have become, they've reached a point, I had to, just to save my energy, I had to establish criteria that the child must have accumulated weapons before I would see them, because there were too many who would draw pictures of blowing up the school. So I've seen a lot of kids who got to the point of collecting weapons ready to shoot up their school. Now, let me tell you that every one of them was male, and every one of them worshipped strongly sadistic men. The most popular of all was Adolf Hitler.
Yeah.
The second most popular was Joseph Stalin. And the third most popular was Charlie Manson.
Yeah.
They shared that as these are people who are strong and they're willing to stand up for their wishes, desires, and principles.
Then
against all odds and against anything anybody says.
So in other words, narcissopaths, you've coined the term narcissopathic. Yeah. Narcissopaths.
Yeah, I think I called them narcissopaths.
Narcissopaths, yeah. I thought that was a really good label, actually. I thought, I mean, of course it's a funny label, but yeah, narcissopaths.
The reason I thought all this, and we never really got it going like so many things, is if you take that view, whatever else you do, and I'm in favor of all the protection and, you know, police involvement when necessary and training programs and self-defense and all that, but if you pay attention to the way children and teachers interact and you prevent the cult formation process,
yeah.
I can tell you how to do, Jill.
If yes,
you
have
a school that's coming up, I think you will do a lot of prevention. I mentioned a case of a boy that I treated independently in Topeka, Kansas, who'd come to live with his father. His parents were split up. And he went to Columbine. And he'd been with his mother in Littleton. And he'd spent 6 months with her, and he could not stand to be there. He loved his mother, but he hated Columbine worse. And I asked him why. Because by the time I saw him, this massacre had already occurred. He said two things. Very bad bullying. And he said, I hated going to school because I had this idea that something really bad was going to happen. Those are his exact words.
He came
to Topeka 6 months before that massacre. He knew something was wrong with that school, which, yeah, by the way, had an anti-bullying program. I've never been able to find out which one. I imagine
right.
Nobody wants anybody to know who invented it. The thing I'd love to say here is if the FBI here will cooperate 100% with communities, I guarantee it. I know it. As you know, I consult with the FBI.
Yeah.
And I'm proud to do that.
Yeah.
And not proud because of their, you know, criminal behavior and all the stuff in the past. But the work I do with them is well above board and very, very altruistic. And
yes,
I can guarantee that can be stopped in especially the at-risk schools, Jill, are the big high schools. High schools with 2,000 to 6,000 kids. Because
yes,
nobody can keep track of 2,000 to 6,000 kids. The Columbine principal I got to know quite well. I met him and spent hours with him. This guy didn't know the names of all of his teachers, and he never saw students or taught a class. He was busy talking to parents who were angry about their kids at school, administering discipline, and filling out paperwork. And I said, how do you feel about that? And he said, not good at all.
Well, what have they got in place in Columbine at the moment? Well, I mean, what is the culture in 2000?
I've had nothing to do with it.
Mm.
I know they're depressed. I know that. I don't know what they've done. I don't even know what work they've done to try and improve the climate. I think it's a school that's still in shock.
Well, maybe you should take them the Peaceful Schools Project.
If you could come up with an Australian billionaire who would give me $10 million, I would do that in less than you could blink.
Well,
I am only inhibited by a total lack of money. To be absolutely coarsely frank about it, Jill, that
right.
is true. I would do it in a second. And so would my FBI people.
Yeah. Well, you know, we could always try Rupert Murdoch. We'll have to send him a link and see if he's interested. But you know his sister, so...
She's already been very generous to us, the Cassie program. Mm. And her foundation is beyond reproach in terms of the work they've done with us. And the work we've done is good.
Oh, yeah. I'm not comfortable
in going to her anymore. I've gone about as far as I can go, and you know, pretty far. I mean, I've asked her. Right. And she's, you know, the economy is no more stable in Australia than it is in America.
I do.
There are people having to take pinches and tucks in their spending.
Yeah, but it would be, you really need a billionaire or someone like that who might want to do that. But first you'd have to look into the situation. So I can see that I'll just fill in while you can talk to that person for a second if you like.
That was just my wife who came in here not knowing I was in the middle of an interview.
Hello.
So she left.
Good on her. So, look, I've actually got a paper up here. There's a lot of things that you've mentioned that I haven't been, I don't know whether to comment on or not. I could make this slightly more controversial. Were you about to say something, Stephen?
No, I wasn't.
Oh, it's just your face pops up and then I think, oh, Stephen might have a question. But anyway, just to follow on where we're at this very moment, I think I'm in your paper now. This Margaret woman is quite interesting with the six conditions for thought reform, she calls it. And she's actually how sort of cults are generated. So would you like, I'd just like to quickly read them out. It's actually a long link, and I'll put it into Skype for you so you can have a look at it yourself, Stuart, so you can bring it up too. I'll put it in here now and just click on that link. Because this is what I'm looking at, and she just basically says you have to, the conditions create the atmosphere needed to put a thought reform system into place. So a thought reform system is a cult, or it is one form of looking at a cult. Keep the person unaware of what is going on and how he or she is being changed a step at a time. Now, when you talk about Klebold and Harris, what are their first names again? I'm so ignorant about these guys.
Eric. Dylan.
Yeah, well, Eric and Dylan Klebold, right. So Eric was the sort of leader. So if we're calling this a cult, then we're looking, though, mind you, some of the stuff I've read, they reckon that there was, there was Hitler and there were maybe some satanic cults involved within the Columbine School. Within the children, and maybe even into, of course, they have to come from somewhere, the broader community involved in the sort of mind idea formations of, where Klebold got his ideas from. But anyway, so keeping that in mind, Eric Harris, but Dylan Klebold was sort of, you call it like a cult dyad, but in other words, we've got Eric Harris is the main sort of narcissistic leader, whereas Klebold is more of a depressive, I want to commit suicide anyway kind of guy.
Yeah.
Right. So, and also, you've said in your papers, and I've also read otherwhere, that they don't really know how many people were actually involved in the Columbine shooting, because many of the children have said they saw more than two shooters. And that came out on the news at the time too, over American television. But anyway, however big this cult of Columbine was, that isn't really the point, because they're all, my point is about cult formation. So keep the person unaware of what is going on and how he and she are being changed a step at a time is one of the first conditions. The second is control the person's social and or physical environment, especially control the person's time. systematically create a sense of powerlessness in the person, manipulate a system of rewards, punishments, and experiences in such a way to inhibit behavior that reflects the person's former social identity. And we'll go over this, Stuart, if you want to. Manipulate a system of rewards, punishments, and experiences in order to promote learning the group's ideology or belief system and group-approved behaviors, and put forward a closed system of logic and an authoritarian structure. This sounds like schools in a way, that permits no feedback and refuses to be modified, excepting by leadership approval or executive order.
Now, that last point is the only one on that list that I agree with.
Right. Yeah, that's the one that resonated with me.
Yeah. You see, if you have a group of homeless people, they can be fairly easy to make into cult members because they don't have anything. If they lack religion or lack a family or lack a job or lack something that gives them meaning, they become susceptible to cult formation. The best example of that was the group around the Waco group. And there's some very good videotapes out on that you should take a look at if you're interested. It's quite it's an example also of the alcohol, tobacco, and firearms and the FBI. It's not their most proud moment. But it gives you an idea of how a very ordinary person created a group around him of needy people that was that had a rather unsatisfying religious viewpoint, and that at the time of attack by alcohol, tobacco, and firearms, the guy called 911. He called the local sheriff's department because he didn't know why his compound was being attacked. I mean, this guy was a true cult leader in the uneducated sense of the word. And what this woman is trying to, I think this writer is trying to do, is do too much with a process of training, which, you know, will be simple. Her steps would apply to Waco. I doubt if her steps would apply as much to Jonestown. I don't think they would apply much to Columbine in terms of the order of training and the process of being almost like a school for cult members.
Well,
but I think she's right with the idea of the uniting purification ideology, religious or not, not always religious, yep. Certainly not with Columbine.
Yeah,
I think she's absolutely hit it on the head there correctly.
In terms of people thinking that this is an ideal, blissful thing, isn't it? It's like we're always, always, everybody seems to be seeking, if not some sort of gross excitement from some gross perversion, some extreme bliss. You know, that's the ultimate... No?
And I sat down with my trainer this morning in the gym. We had a talk about Kiev and Ukraine and the horrors that are going on there around the central government building.
Yeah.
Where you have, protesters and the police interacting. We had a long discussion about, in the end, what's wrong with the idea that you shouldn't have the sort of government you want? We shouldn't have Vladimir Putin crashing down on you and shooting you when you're not good.
Mm.
And we have a democracy where people can have freedom and have a lot more things. Why can't the two groups live together? It's a good question. I mean, the thing about human beings is they're always looking for some sort of ultimate meaning.
Yes.
That's not escapable, whether it's religious, whether it's philosophical, whether it's even ludicrous, like the fuckhead concept.
Or you Jonestown, keep
which is sort of neo-religious, or I don't know what you would call it. Somebody called Jones a neo-communist or neo-socialist. Whatever it is, it's not. The key is it's not what the people are living in now. And the thing that I don't understand how come highly educated, very intelligent people buy into this?
Yeah, that's what I was, that's what I'm saying too. It's like, is it a, I wonder if they're like Biss and Bass people. I wonder if they're the ones whose behavioral activation system is so strong that they see a reward in it and they're just sort of drawn to it.
Yeah.
Or I wonder if they're the people who or whether, yeah, there'd be both types of people in it too, wouldn't there?
You could be right. I mean, I, as you know, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but with the opening up of the National Security Service stuff with Snowden and others in the last year or so, I've become far less sure of myself in terms of conspiracies.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I mean, some people reckon that Columbine, one of the conspiracies is that Columbine, and I can't know the answer to any of the conspiracies, but as a radio person with people who listen, I can bring up a few controversial points, and that is that some people believe that there's a satanic sort of cult that goes all the way to the White House virtually.
Wow. And
then there are other people who believe that there were lots of gunmen at Columbine at the time, and it was run by the gun lobby because they wanted, to get rid of guns. And there's other conspiracy theories that say that Sandy Hook, some of the people didn't. It goes on and on, some of the ideas that people come up with. And that isn't the real purpose of this interview. The real purpose is to talk about cults and cult formation, because we will always, there'll always be somebody somewhere who may want to manipulate us, and the important thing is how to keep some sort of a clear mind and not become manipulated, I suppose, because the past.
Let me say something that I can't prove to you, although I with Stephen's cooperation and enough time, we'd need probably 20 minutes, maybe 30.
Mm.
You might be able to do this.
Oh, yeah. Are you okay there, Stephen?
Are you here, Stephen? No, he's away. Let me just tell you what it is.
Yeah.
When people collect together in groups,
mm-hmm.
minimum is 8, and it could go up to millions. Their psychology becomes more and more and more primitive and more and more and more open to change of a nature that we see in cults.
What causes that? What happens? We get some sort of basically sort of group, a more primitive response to dealing with a group.
Uh-huh. My feeling is this. I'll give you the now we're down to my feeling as an analyst.
Yeah.
I think, as you know, that we're basically as evil as we are good. And the negative side of us is not that below the surface. It requires largely a large number of our peers to say the same thing. So if everybody is saying, this guy Hitler sounds like he's sort of crazy, but, you know, I've noticed that my minister and my bookkeeper and my friends and my school teacher all believe him, maybe he's okay.
Yep. Good pressure.
Here's what I could offer you, because and I've experienced this before. Mm-hmm. If you give me half an hour with the two of you,
yeah,
I could drive you crazy. Right here on Skype.
Right. Well, are we
almost nothing.
Oh, okay, that'd be interesting. Well, I'd like to play that game, preferably not on air, because I'd love you to try and drive me crazy.
Now, I'm saying this.
Yeah.
The fact that larger groups of people become crazy is it's a clinical fact.
Yeah.
It's not hard to show. It's quite easy to set up. And my answer to your question, what causes this?
Yeah.
This is not an answer of a scientist. This is the answer of a clinician.
Yes, this is what I'm interested in.
I'll show you.
Okay. Would you really? Can I invite you to do that for us off air, please? I mean, you are bored for the next few weeks. It's better than television.
If you do want an off-air session, you might want to privately tape record it. It would be very, very interesting for you. I'd have to set you up in a way that you would be lying on the couch and relaxed and certain things.
It's taking advantage of us, isn't it? Can we make this a guy?
Jill, you'd be the very first one to become a cult follower.
I already have been a cult follower. But anyway.
I can't have an answer in terms of straightforward logic. I can show you what happens. I can show you what happens with very intelligent people like you and Stephen. I can show you what happens with anybody. I can tell you why I think it happens in that original paper on Jonestown. But can I put it into simple-minded language? The only way I can say it is we are much more capable of craziness than most of us have thought. The only group of psychologists that buy into this are English, called Kleinians. Melanie Klein was a famous analyst that had a big influence in England. They know that. They assume we're all crazy, psychotic, by the grace of God, and a good, this is just a joke, a grace of God, a good mother, and good genes, we managed to control our illness. Jill, have you ever gone out and it started to rain and you've said, I knew it would rain because I forgot my umbrella?
Yes, I've been known to say these sorts of things.
And isn't that a psychotic statement?
Yeah. Yes, it is.
And so the Kleinians say that's trivial, normal, of no consequence. But it is part of human thinking. We tend to think like we're the center of the universe, that God would, of course, rain on us to punish us, you know?
Yeah. When I think things like that, I think, oh, God, I'm a narcissist. I can't believe that I think I'm the center of the universe. Pardon?
It's not narcissism. I think it's psychosis.
Oh, gee, I'm psychotic. I'll say that instead then.
You and I share that, Jill.
Yeah.
We share it. I'm psychotic also. Yeah. I do that all the time with the weather.
Yeah. Oh, well, especially, you know, I've actually been at a lot of rainmaking ceremonies with Tibetan lamas, and then at the end of them they've said, well, it'll rain in 3 days, and it has rained in 3 days. So I am psychotic enough to believe I can definitely have a lot to do with the weather. And being a water snake, born in the year of the water snake, you've really got me on a good psychosis here, thanks, Stuart. Because I've made rain a lot, you know. and who knows?
May really just be being open to any knowledge, you know.
That's
like
true.
Your knowledge. Yeah. I know the Tibetan rainmaking. I know the Tibetan temperature raising. I know, you know, my first meditation teacher was Kogyam Trungpa. You know, I'm very familiar with all of that. Mm. I know it happens, but it's not part of Western science.
No.
Maybe that's a step to happen in the future.
Oh, yeah. Well, I remember just for mind-opening follow-on and what you're saying to all people who are hearing this mad woman speak, when one day when we had a terrible drought and the tank was completely empty and Yeshikadra, this nun who I was a nun with, she said, oh, we're going to have to ask the lamas to make rain. And so we go and ask the lamas, will you please make rain? They said, yeah, come up to the house and we'll do it together. And we go up there and we do it. And then the wind hits you in the face in a certain way and our job is to generate compassion. And then basically at the end, the lama said, okay, it's going to rain in 3 days. It rained until I was actually under the gompa, under the temple at an underground water tank. As the last drop of water fell into the top of the rim of the water tank that day.
Speaking of
being psychotic, and then I go down the road and I talk to the people down the road and they go, your lamas made that rain, didn't they? And I'm going, well, yeah, we did have a ceremony, or, you know, we did do this thing. And she said, oh, I know, I felt the energy coming from down there, coming from down the hill just before it rained. And so, yes, this is a marvelous group psychosis that I enjoy participating in. Thank you very much. I'm just going to read a little bit from your paper while we're talking about cult formation. I'm just going to read out the five stages of a cult formation, just so that people, because you, actually I'm a really good example of it. How can you stay sane, get interested in what could be considered cults, be interested in the paranormal, be interested in the unknown aspects of the psyche, you know, I am an anti-eugenist in a way. Like, how do you marry the spirit and the body? Like, are we just body and mind? We can get sucked into so many things, and we have to be so careful of so many things. But anyway, in stage one, the leader embodies the group fantasy, and followers both admire and denigrate him. At Columbine, a cult-like atmosphere pervaded the school, and among the staff and students, there was an extraordinarily intense commitment to being exceptional and different. But they were sort of outstanding in academics, and not academics, in athletics at Columbine, weren't they?
They were both good.
Yeah, and then
at one time that school was the second best high school in the United States.
Wow, it was called the Jewel of Colorado.
Yeah,
just the name is romantic, isn't it?
Yeah.
In stage two, group and leader become pseudo-speciated.
Yeah.
That is, the group dyad, or the group or the dyad, is created to defend itself against a dangerous, unjust, and rejecting world. Well, you've sort of covered that in a way, Stuart, haven't you? The group's leader, omnipotent mindset, generates extreme ideas and identifies people to be ridiculed. So then we get this othering, right, don't we? This is... What does pseudo-speciated mean?
It just means it's a term Erikson coined to describe. He was primarily dealing with Nazis at the time he invented it, and he and several Robert Coles was a famous writer on sociology and anthropology. And he and Erik Erikson knew each other. And it was a question of how could an intelligent people who are not small in numbers become so crazy about a man who was so disturbed as Adolf Hitler? Mm. That was the issue. And Erikson's theory was the leader pseudo-speciates the group, and the group pseudo-speciates the leader, so that its idea is that it's more important than any concept the rest of the world has about it.
It's sort of like a false label, isn't it? Pseudo-false. Yeah. Speciated is a species is a label. So they're just sort of...
Crazy label.
Right.
Way of putting it. Crazy label.
Okay. I was thinking, look, because we've only got 20 minutes left, if we could look at this as well, bringing in the video games and seeing it in a way like we see life as a video game too, and that people were playing all these video games when they do all this shooting and killing.
Yeah.
So, like, we could marry the three in a way, not just two. So if we just think about how that happens when we're in this sort of unreal world, like recently, Stuart, it was so funny. I want to do a show on it. There are these people who play this game called Second Life. Have you heard about it? Oh, well, I met a man in a wheelchair, and he goes and plays on Second Life. And I said to him, I met him in the pub, I said, do you run around? He said, oh, yeah, I run and I do it. I said, what do you like? And he's this really old man, but in Second Life, which is a video game, a virtual game, he's an athletic, spunky young man. And he has a castle and a speedboat, and he even had to go and buy a penis. Yes. But it's surreal money too. But anyway, it's really hilarious. And anyway, we are going to do a show on these people who, you can come if you like. who plays Second Life, because I think it's hilarious. And you meet him, and he says, his son was telling me, his son's a divine guy. They have an art gallery, and they put up shows on this thing, Second Life, and invited people who are in Second Life, and they come to it. But anyway, I've forgotten what I was going to say now. His son says, when he meets people, the very first question he asks them is, are you in Second Life? So it's sort of like, it's like for him, like it really hit me. This is when Morgan, his name is, told me, it's sort of like, you're not real unless you're in Second Life. Like, okay. You know, reality is like the illusion.
Yeah.
Anyway,
that reminds me, by the way, of cults.
Yeah, well, this is why I brought it up. This group, Dyad, is created to defend itself against a dangerous, unjust, and rejecting world. The group's leader, omnipotent mindset, generates extreme ideas and identifies people to be ridiculed. Stage three is a resting place. Now, this seems to me like this is like a rite of passage. And if you're getting into the resting place, then this is like what you call the interstitial place when you're going through a rite of passage, isn't it? This resting place is like...
I think so. It's like, you know... Let's think this over. Is this correct or not? You know, the intelligent person will want to think it through.
Yeah.
And that did happen at the Columbine. The extent to which this happened at, not Columbine, I mean Jonestown, the extent it happened at Columbine has to do with a number of things Harris did that were lecturing to classes and giving people views on the work they were supposed to do. Remember, this guy was 4.0, memorized a Shakespearean play. He was brilliant. He could show his peers that he was brilliant and tell them the way whenever he could, when the teachers weren't listening. And the teachers at Columbine were full of difficulties. The athletic director had all sorts of personal problems. There were unpleasant relationships between staff members and other staff members and the spouses of staff members. And the athletic coach was sort of the leader of the school rather than the principal.
And did he have a good character? You're not, saying he didn't.
You know, I wouldn't say that in any sort of slandering way. I don't know. It's just that this particular paper you're reading, I looked at three books.
Yeah.
One of them by Cullen was very much against the idea that they were anything other than psychopaths.
Yeah, well, Cullen's meant to be.
Phil was different. It looked at more than just Columbine.
Yeah.
They decided that there were crazy people and not crazy. And Columbine, a true crime story by Jeff Cass, was entirely focused on the bullying and victimization part of Columbine and the cult formation. Not called cult, but the idea that the school was not functioning properly vis-a-vis staff and students. So you have three books there. And, you know, I encourage you to read them. Columbine by Cullen is an exhausting read. It's a typical book by an investigative journalist, you know.
My poor mirror neurons. I don't want any more of this foul rubbish in my mirror neurons.
Of information you would never want to know.
Yeah. Well, we're really just interested, like, as you know, about this, like, about... Not, well, we form little cults. What's the difference between a cult and a clique, really? I mean, maybe it's sort of like, you know, there must be an infantile. Like, if it's a narcissistic psychopath, then when you think about it, as we're all children and as narcissism is a sort of a phase, then maybe there's a part of ourselves that just has that childlike approach to society that we have innately, as our childlike approach, as you were saying, that children adore their parents. You know, that parents have so much power over children.
Well, that's what eventually happens with the cult leader. He becomes as an unquestionable parental figure.
Yeah.
The point is that the difference between a parent and a cult leader is this. A cult leader is held ambivalently. That is, he's not only loved, he's hated.
Yes.
In other words, if the cult leader doesn't produce, the whole group will turn against him.
Right.
For the parent, that's not true. The parent is always the great person. And, you know, I don't know if you experience this, but a lot of kids, you know, find out their parents were actually wrong about certain things. One of my kids, I won't mention which one, I told him the moon was made of green cheese. And I heard him when he was about 10 insisting that the moon was made of green cheese because his dad said he was. It was.
Yeah.
And, you know, I wish I hadn't said that. I had a long talk to him.
Yeah.
So the average kid really worships their parents, and when they find their parents are defective, they often become very disappointed.
We all do.
See, there's always this ambivalence. Mm. I both love you and hate you. I love you if you do what I want. I hate you if you don't do what I want.
Yeah, that's that me thing. I feel as though I've sort of got to try and work out how we can bring a whole lot of lateral thinking, which you and I are both laden with by the look of it, into some sort of conclusion here. In stage four, the world becomes even more dangerous and the cult's extremism and paranoia increase. Harris became even more deceptive in his apparent good behavior and was supported by remarkable accolades from blah, blah, for everybody. And then a psychotic fantasy of group death ensues. The leader becomes a revolutionary martyr. So this is in cults that kill anyway, because there's all sorts of different cults, aren't there?
Yeah, lots of different,
But today we were talking about cults, and we've only sort of got about 5 to 10 minutes left. So I just sort of want to make sure that you get to talk about, like, would you like to sum up in a nutshell what do you think cults are all about? I've actually got a couple of questions here. Cults appear when there's a breakdown in the structure of society, how to relate to it and reconstitute it. So it seems that people are going, right, society's no good. I want to reconstitute society, and I choose to do it this way. That's basically how cults are. And then depending on whether they're led by a humanitarian or a narcissist, and the motivation, I suppose, is everything.
Yeah. Well, you know, you've raised a $64,000 question, way beyond cults and Columbine and schools and you know, all the stuff we've been talking about. The big issue, I mean, has come up. I mean, the focus of it at the moment is on Ukraine and what's going on there in Kiev.
Yep.
And you've read today apparent truce and then the fire ring around the government building and who trusts who. And so what would you say if Vladimir Putin said, listen, I hate communism. I'm nothing like Joseph Stalin. I just know what Russians are and this is how we do it. If people confront us, we knock them back. We'll kill them if necessary. That's not how you do it, but why can't you just let us do it our way? We're not democratic in that sense. Mm.
Yeah,
you
because
do it your
I,
way, we do it our way, and why can't we talk?
Mm.
And Obama says if you cross a red line, you're going to be axed by the United States, which the United States could actually ax Russia now. But why should we do that? I don't understand whether there is any solution to this that would make any sort of common sense. The step I've taken, without any real knowledge, I've submitted a grant to the Center for Disease Control that's under consideration now to try and create neighborhoods within which guerrilla-beating real men's men and quiet, soft, effeminate gay people would live in harmony. Can you believe that?
Oh, it happens in my hometown every day.
And I think that could happen in Miami-Dade County, that you probably read as one of the most violent places in America.
Yeah.
We're working to try and create neighborhoods where people want to live with massive differences between the people who are living there.
Yeah.
Why do they all have to be the same?
Exactly. Well, actually, this is where people struggle because they go along with, sameness and otherness and all men are created equal and no men are created equal. But I think what's really important in answer to, you, not that I have the answers, is we have to recognize what where we are the same. And then it brings you back to pure, Tibetan philosophy, which is, what do I want? I want happiness. What does Stuart want? He wants happiness. What does Stephen want? He wants happiness. We are all equal in our desire to find happiness.
But Vladimir Putin would say, I don't want happiness. What I want is the Russian people to feel satisfied.
Okay, well then that's him skipping a step away from the underneath basic question, because that is his idea of happiness, is for the Russian people to feel satisfied.
Correct.
Yeah, so it's...
Now, if the Russian people can only feel satisfied by shooting a whole lot of protesters in Ukraine, why is that not okay?
Oh, well, this is where he really needs to start studying some sort of... because the other person's idea of happiness is not to be shot, so he's not recognizing the other person's desire in where we are the same.
That's right.
Which is, yeah.
There's only the Russian viewpoint as embodied by Vladimir Putin.
Yeah, oh, Vladimir Putin.
There's no other people in the world but him.
Russia,
the majority, many Russians do not buy his point of view.
Because he is, in the terms of Stuart Twemlow, a narcissopath.
That's what he is.
He's a narcissopath.
All right.
Yeah, we should wrap up now, Jill.
All right. Well, we're time to go, Stephen?
Okay, yes, it is.
So thank you so much, Professor Twemlow. It's been interesting, and we won't join the cult of Putin. Nor the cult of many things, and also video games. It's a whole topic that I want to get into somewhere with someone. And Second Life, there's so many things that we have to explore, but I think the most important thing is to, I'm in a mood for telling people how to think now. Keep a good heart and recognize, and I think that's what you're doing, Professor Twemlow. Thank you so much for working on Peaceful Schools projects and trying to help people stay in touch with their own inner compassion and help create peaceful neighborhoods.
Right.
Stephen Roberts.
If any of your listeners, and I can't, there's no correct way of saying this, have any way of raising a few million dollars to start to bring into reality what we discussed over the past 6 or 8 or 10 discussions, please let me know. I could, for what it's worth, almost guarantee you will not be dissatisfied. I mean, I understand that's just a personal statement, but anybody who knows me knows that I deliver what I say I'm going to deliver. And that's been one of the things that got me the name as a young person of wizard. And if there is a wealthy person who's looking for a place to finance some of our ideas, they should let you and Stephen know.
Well,
I'm
they
not
should.
Joking here. I'm 72 years of age. I've got maybe 10 good years left, and that's not very many.
Mm. So you're talking about putting a peaceful project into Columbine, or what are we financing here?
Talking about setting up a community health situation. I could set it up in an academic setting. Best. Could be done privately. And we could do this approach in many settings. I'd like to go to Sandy Hook in a school still smarting from its problem. Columbine, I'd like to take a look at it. The FBI, what they want to do is interview every school shooter that's still alive and find out exactly what went on. So there's still a lot of people interested in doing research on this.
Yep.
And it could be done, and it could propose example. I have a very good friend, sociologist friend. He's in England now. He thinks that you could change a whole community by changing how they see terminally ill people. You know, there's nobody can attack a terminally ill people. The worst serial killer in the world would melt for a terminally ill person.
And we are all terminally ill, aren't we?
Except
I mean,
we aren't acutely terminally ill. So if we
were,
the idea he has is that would change how a city operates.
Yep,
it would. Great idea. He wants to create compassionate communities. That's what he calls them.
I get it.
My job, my future is to create compassionate communities.
Yep, I really recognize that. And I see that sort of with Thanatos looming on the horizon, you want to make sure that you've given so much, you know, to look after the planet, that really sort of big desire to teach compassion.
Jill.
Yes, Stephen.
Thanatos. I know how powerful it is. I'm worried about it.
Yep. With that, we should all be worried about that, because we are terminally ill and we're all going to die. So it's not about whether God accepts it or not. It's about whether we have a peaceful mind. And may we all create peaceful minds right here, right now. Stuart Twemlow, thank you so much.
No problem.
Thank you.